Welcome to Notice That, an EMDR podcast. Here, you will find discussion on all things EMDR from MDRI-approved trainers and consultants, as well as some co-hosts. EMDR is an approach to the entire therapeutic journey, not just reprocessing trauma. This podcast will feature a discussion on the therapeutic relationship, understanding and using the original eight-phase protocol, and what to do to bring deeper understanding to the why behind EMDR and what to do when you're stuck. This podcast is an invitation to connect and learn together about EMDR and the process of psychotherapy. We are glad that you're here.
Thanks for checking out this podcast. Notice That is a project of Think Beyond, a listener-funded media house focused on connecting humans through therapy and art. To keep this podcast going, we'd love for you to support us on Patreon by searching patreon.com/thinkbeyondhealing in your favorite web browser. And don't forget to check out our new merch by going to our website at connectbeyondhealing.com and clicking on the merchandise tab.
Hey guys, welcome back to Notice That, an EMDR podcast. Bridger and I are here today to talk about chapter 6 in the book. I think that's right. I'm looking at you for validation.
Yes, on that.
Okay, thank you. I'm working from the old book here.
Yeah,
so
you know what we're talking
about.
But where is it in the new edition?
Same. Yeah, chapter 6. But regardless of what chapter it's in, we're getting into desensitization.
Yes.
So we're going to continue with our discussion, moving through the eight phases, and specifically focus on phase 4 today. Before we get into that, though,
let's so there's talk not about, an awkward interjection.
Right. Yeah, we'll do some awkward thing at the end, I'm sure.
Yes, but, it'll come up.
The summit.
Yeah.
Is coming up.
It is
really soon.
It is April 18th through the 22nd. In Bellevue, Washington.
Yeah. So we're going to be there.
That's
hosting
right.
The event, if you haven't heard already.
That's right. Yeah. Really excited. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
When's the last in-person conference you attended?
It was for like therapy before the pandemic.
That's what is in my mind is like, I have not.
Yeah. I've gone to several for like counselor ed stuff.
Since the pandemic?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm curious how my body's going to respond to being in a pool of people.
Yeah. When the last one I went to was in November of last year. And I presented at a conference in Baltimore. And it was weird. Like, everybody was still kind of freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you could tell that everybody was kind of like, I don't know.
Right,
how to
doing
be in
this, but
person again.
Yeah.
But this one should be interesting because it'll be nice weather.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I believe this is Andrea's first big event live or in person since COVID.
Yeah.
So it's a big kind of celebration of getting back to commingling with other EMDR clinicians and all the fun festivities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I am excited. And a lot of the speakers, their topics look really good.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
Same.
Yeah. And then we have a meetup that's for the Notice That community happening on the Thursday night at 7:30. To find details on that, you'll want to follow our event page inside our Beyond Healing community. So if you go to our website and look at the For Therapists tab, there's a community section there if you're not already a member. But that's where we'll post details about where we'll be and when we'll be. But right now we're still trying to gauge how many people are coming so we know what type of event and what type of space to try and locate. So for details on that, you'll want to follow the event inside Mighty Networks.
But regardless of how it plays out, the intention is that we all get to hang out.
And just be
like
ourselves.
Meet some people who want to talk about the things and that we like to talk about and relax, hang out, and just mingle and interact. So
yes.
If that sounds fun to you and you're going to be in that area, Oh, I had a couple people that are like, I'm not going to be at the summit, but I'm going to come.
Yeah, because I'm local. Guys. Yeah. Yes.
So if you're anywhere close to that and you just want to come for a happy hour or a hangout or something after, please join in and RSVP and let us know that you'll be there, and we'll look forward to meeting you.
Absolutely. I'm excited. And then we also have a couple new groups starting.
Yes.
This spring.
Yeah. Or into the summer. In addition to like trainings, we do 6-month consultation cohorts. So these are groups of anywhere from like 5 to 10 clinicians that come together and meet once a month for 90 minutes over the span of 6 months.
Yeah.
And we have one starting on like a clinical application of our case conceptualization training. So somatic integration and processing. And that will be led by you.
Yes.
And Caleb or Caleb?
The clinical application will be just me. We do have an advanced group that's going to start sometime in May. That'll be Caleb and I.
Nice.
Together.
Okay.
So that'll be fun.
So if you've taken the SIP training, or even if you haven't and want to take it asynchronously with consultation, you can find that on the website. That's called SIP and Clinical Application. The other offering is actually going to be led by a therapist that we have trained and done consultation with now for a few years, Kim Dalton.
Yeah.
I can't think of exactly how long it's been, but time's funny like that.
Yeah.
You know?
I want to say like at least 4 years.
It's been a while. Yeah. So she has done probably just about every training or consultation thing that we have. Very talented clinician, and she's going to lead an EMDR refresh group. So if anyone is wanting just to kind of refresh an EMDR, the curriculum that's a part of that is all presented by Melissa and I through video. And so you get to watch that, earn MDRIA credit, and then have consultation with Kim. Really, her specialty is on kind of developing like confidence in EMDR clinicians. So if you're feeling kind of an uncertainty of where you're at or who you are as an EMDR clinician, she would be a great group to join with. So you could also find that on the website.
Yep. And ConnectBeyondHealing.com.
Yes. Register there.
Yes.
All right. All that aside.
Snap.
Let's roll.
Yes. So, Jen.
Yes, Bridger.
What comes up when you think about desensitization?
That's way too broad of a question.
No, it's a great traverse through the surface level.
No. I hate it.
Hated the first
what
question. Okay.
What do you
let me check my notes here.
Go to the next one.
Associative processing?
Yeah. That's okay, a little that's bit better. Worse.
Okay. No. Let's talk about what desensitization is a little bit. Okay.
Yes. What comes up? Well, first is I immediately think of where it's placed in the 8 phases, and knowing that our previous chapters we've been talking about like the assessment, accessing and activating that target. So now we're moved into like what people think of as the meat of EMDR.
Yeah.
I don't agree with that statement, but when you think of EMDR, most people are thinking of this phase right here.
Yeah.
And that's what people call EMDR, even though
they're talking about desensitization.
Yeah. What initially comes up for you? What's your first thoughts about?
Yeah. I mean, for me, this is like the opportunity within the EMDR framework where we actually get to take the thing out of the box and start playing with it. Feels like everything up to now is about getting us to this moment. And now we're ready to use everything that we've been talking about, all the preparation we've been doing, all the history taking, et cetera, to actually hit play on something. And that's the first thought that comes up. The second is similar to what you shared, which is that this is just a piece of a much larger context.
Yeah.
But this is one of the first times that we're really getting to utilize the preparation and resourcing and ride the wave of the activation we did in the assessment on a very specific thing. So in some ways, this for me is one of my favorite parts of EMDR because we get to point the therapeutic alliance's attention at one thing. And that's a really cool, like, co-creative process for me.
It feels like it's this process of getting to like harness and channel everything up into that point into a one specific direction.
Yep.
which has so much power.
Yes.
Right? Like the potential power and intensity in that can be really change, like transformational in the therapy process and for the client. But we want to kind of be aware of like, what are we channeling? What are we like pushing play on, and how we regulate that, and what all can become a part of that?
Yeah. And that power that you're talking about, to me, the way I feel with my clients is that this will be activating and hopefully ultimately result in healing for the client as we progress through the stages. I'm also going to learn a ton.
So much.
When we hit play on this thing. So there's the horror stories that you hear of EMDR therapists in which when desensitization starts, the therapist starts
checks
playing
out
Candy Crush or something. Like, yeah. And kind of tunes out because the client is doing their own thing. Mm-hmm. And you just need to like let them do that. And I think that the Candy Crush is one thing, but like, but actually letting the client do their thing, I do believe in that. But for me, I feel like my work adds a new level of depth when I'm with a client in the desensitization phase, because I'm starting to learn how they orient to channeling, like you're talking about, all of that energy and preparation and resourcing that we've done to this specific target. And I get to learn what I call like the physics of their mind. I get to see that starting to play out as they experience distress, what else comes up, what doesn't come up, how accessible are the resources that we've built, how inaccessible are they, and what glimpses of the core of their presentation can I gain through even this one target?
Yeah. And this will get, as we go through the material in the chapter, we'll start getting into this, but like there are so many layers of depth and information and experience when we really do go into that specific moment. A lot of the phases up till this point and just in therapy in general, we're kind of high level looking at something, maybe different degrees of like how removed are we, but we're kind of like talking about the trauma or the past experience, or we're talking about their symptoms. This is where it feels like we go into them. Mm-hmm. We go back into it and bring it all alive. And then there's layers upon layers of experience and information and history that can unfold from that place.
Yeah, absolutely. The first component of the chapter gets into this idea of associative processing. And to kind of flesh it out so that we can talk about it, associative processing embraces the idea of what you're saying, that when you activate one specific idea or target or experience, you're extending an invitation to the client to share and embrace and journey through their sensory interoceptive and exteroceptive experience with the meaning on top of it. You know, we talk about in one of our trainings just how full and rich a person's sensory system is. And that's what we kind of are gaining access to when we step into the assessment and desensitization phase. We're activating all of that material. And then in desensitization, we're starting to let it unfold and emerge throughout these various levels of associative processing. And the way that Francine outlines this is through some major kind of categories with imagery, sounds and thoughts, getting into sensation and affect throughout kind of the major channels of association as conceptualized in EMDR.
Yeah, I'm looking at the categories and it's feeling interesting to me in how that's broken down. I don't know what I want to say about that yet.
Interesting in what way?
Like imagery is one thing, and then sound and thoughts are a separate category.
Yeah.
My mind holds those differently.
Mm-hmm.
And sensation and affect all being together, my mind holds those a bit separate. Yep. So
I think it's all the same information. I'm just trying to wrap my head around like the way the chapter breaks in my own head and how those live.
Yeah.
With those in considering associative channels. And really, I mean, when I talk in consultation and in trainings and things, we were talking about channels of processing and what can be included in that and how much the assessment phase kind of already foreshadows for us what those channels will be. Mm-hmm. And looking at cognition and thoughts, looking at emotion and affect, looking at body sensation, looking at the expression of imagery, and to me, like imagery, sound, like all that kind of goes together. Mm-hmm. And so those are kind of how the chapter breaks in my mind of organizing what are those channels that we're going to be like seeing what kind of associative material yeah. exists in each of those.
Yeah. And I think it's somewhat, for me, one of the limitations of using our psychology to talk about an experience of our body. Mm. And we've talked about this at length in several of our trainings, but this is a construct
yeah.
to help break up for the ease of access to something that is very intimate and complex in the client's system. So for me, the four nodes of the associative channels, like there's amazing depths of research about each mm-hmm. node. And also looking at the bias of the EMDR process that we're trying to shift into resolution, a maladaptively stored traumatic incident or experience. So the way we're conceptualizing the effects of that traumatic experience are through this target node mm-hmm. or the associative channels of where the tendrils of that traumatic experience go in the client's system.
Yeah.
So for me, that's important to know, because we can then talk about it however we want to, looking at the different elements of reaction or response to the traumatic experience that the quote unquote maladaptively stored material has taken root.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the overarching concept in that then is that it's not as simple as one channel of processing.
Yeah.
Right? Like we have to be aware that however we label the channels, however we yeah. conceptualize them, it's complex.
Yeah. Experientially, you can't get into just one.
Right. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be layered, it's going to be complex. And that as we go through what looks like a really linear protocol that we have, knowing that the processing itself won't play out as linear as that.
Yeah.
Once you're in this phase, it's not going to be a step A, B, C, D, and we're done. It's going to be an A, B, C, oh, back to A, B, oh, back to A, B, C, D, E, F.
Like, yeah, right.
It is a circling through or kind of a looping through this material to say, what are we covering coming back to the activating experience? What else is there?
Yeah.
And that can make this phase feel hard to track. It can make it, you know, for some clinicians, it's like a little bit challenging of how do we know where we are and what we're doing and where we're headed. And I think there's a lot of tools that have been implemented to help us. But the most important thing, I think, is like just being able to like be right with the client as they go through this and mm-hmm. have enough understanding to know it's complex and we can kind of keep checking back in, but allowing their system to go as it needs to go and us staying and tracking right there with them.
Yeah. I do appreciate that in the language of the chapter, the point is on what emerges.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is an intimate trust in the client's process. Again, assuming that we have thoroughly activated the assessment material and we're ready to ride the wave of that activation through the processing experience of desensitization, what comes up is going to be the point. I was working with a group of consultees this last week, and they were processing. They each had a case that was kind of similar in when they check in after the first set, a flurry of memories comes up. Mm-hmm. Like the client said, well, it's not just this one memory now, it's all of these.
Yeah.
And would kind of burst into this and wanted to process and talk about, well, it's this one and this was happening, and then it's this one and this was happening, and on and on. And that can be kind of overwhelming, I think, mm-hmm. as a therapist of like, okay, do I just say like,
client.
Yeah, for sure. But as the therapist, do I say just, okay, go with that? Or how do I know what to do with what comes up after that first BLS set?
Yeah. I feel like each of these kind of subtitles of like the things that can come up, new memory, changes in the image, continued unfolding of the incident, all of these, it's the question that you ask in that, like, what do you do with what comes up? There's tremendous decision-making power in each one of these, of it's maybe not just as simple as go with that every single time.
Yeah.
That's a great default if we're not sure yet. But there's a lot of decision for the client and for the therapist to join the client in saying, we may have to make decisions as we go based on maybe six new memories come up and we have to make a decision. Do we go with one? Do we go back to the original?
Yeah.
Do we contain? Do we just say go with that and see what happens? And maybe their system's going to unfold that naturally.
Yeah.
Maybe a whole new image pops up.
Yeah.
Do we notice that? Like how do we proceed with each one of these?
Yeah. For me, the important part is to not lose the through line of
describe what you mean.
Yeah. So what's going on? Because theoretically, like anything could come up.
Right.
And that's where, when I first shared what came up for me thinking about desensitization for our conversation today, is that component of, through this process, I'm going to catch glimpses of the core of what this client is actually experiencing, not just in this incident, but in their life in general. That whatever we get to spend our time on will show me a side of the diamond. Like, it'll show me a piece of it. And how can I start to collect a landscape of the core through an individual target that we're working on? So with the flurry of things that might come up, I'm sitting in a posture as the therapist to not chase every rabbit that comes up, but to see where they're coming from as best I can. And that's one of the ways that I teach this. I use parts language a lot, both in my therapy sessions as well as in my teaching. And it's like a part of them through the activation, as they were holding all of these memories, all of this stuff, saw an opportunity to be seen. And so they rushed forward and like dumped it all on the ground.
Yeah.
And to the client, that can feel overwhelming because that part was created to hold all that stuff. And so it's kind of like, whoa, I didn't even know that was there. And here it is all dumped on the floor. And then they're kind of like, what am I supposed to tell the therapist about? Because here's all this stuff. I don't really know what to make of any of this. A lot of those sensations, if that's how the client is showing up, that's kind of the way I conceptualize that, is that the assessment was successful in showing an invitation that felt acceptable to the part of them that had been holding all this for however long. And so they came rushing forward and they weren't polite about it necessarily. They just like threw down all of this stuff, memories, sounds, thoughts, like all of these components of the associative processing are like randomly, seemingly collected by this part, and they're just throwing it up on the ground. And so it would be very confusing to just pick up one and try and see like, what is this? What is this sound of your mother's voice? Why is this coming up? We were talking about an interaction you had with an abuser over here, different than your mom, but like, why is this coming up now? And in some way, that part is showing you, I have ideas about this. Like, I think I know where it comes from, but I don't know how to make sense of the parts. I don't know how to make sense of the pieces. And to me, if a client can actually engage in the desensitization phase, like we hit play and stuff starts happening, that's an amazing opportunity that their body is saying, there's a chance that I could work through a lot of the stuff that I don't understand. and what a kindness and truly like a sacred opportunity it is for us to get to bear witness to that and to help, because these are things that they've struggled to make sense of since it happened.
Yeah, I feel like in that example, if we are too fixated on the content specifically and not looking at the process of how it's unfolding, a therapist could take that moment and say, oh, okay, we have 4 new potential targets.
Right.
Add them to the list. Like, these are all associated. We may or may not have to actually work on them, but I'm going to list them. Say, could you contain those? We'll go back to the original experience, do a reboot. Yes. Notice that, because we're seeing each piece of content as something to be focused on and like interacting with. But if instead we shift more to a process focus,
yeah,
that's where we're going to pause in that and say, I wonder why in this moment that took place.
Yeah.
Why was all of that content delivered in this moment? Why would that make sense?
Yes.
And that might be the question we ask in our own head as the therapist, as we decide, what do we do? Like, are we just going to go with that? Or it could be an interweave that we're using. Mm-hmm. Why does it make sense to you that all of this just showed up?
Yeah. One of the questions I ask in that is, and I shared this with the consultee group as well, like, of all that's coming up, what is the core of it?
Mm. What's that through line?
Yeah. What's the core? And I'll say that to the client as an invitation for them to go wherever they want to go, not saying what's the worst part of it or what's an interweave that picks up from a content posture, like one of the things. But I try to invite them to help me see what their body is doing and sharing it with me. What's the core of this? And usually they pick up what I'm trying to get at.
To get reorients with all of that in mind, all of that being acknowledged, not shut it away and then go back to a different core.
Yeah.
With all of that being present, what's the core here? What's the common piece? What's the theme? Why is it making sense that this is all showing up?
Yeah.
And when you get the answer to that, to me, that's right. Now we go with that, right? It like found something that holds all of that. And then we notice there.
Yeah. Because usually in the answer to that question, what I hear is in some way reflections on the self and its expression. So like that incident that I just said was a real one. Like, mom's voice, we're talking about an abuser over here in a separate part of your life. And as we picked up on some of these core things, I asked, or some of these component pieces, I asked, like, what is the core of this? And it was, I guess I've just never felt safe, something to that effect. Like, I've never felt safe standing up for myself. Mm-hmm. And mom's tone of voice was in that bucket of stuff that was dumped out. And so we left the target memory, quote unquote, of this abuse. And now we're talking about feeling safe in the world. Mm-hmm. Like, what the core was perhaps this hypothesis that we're testing throughout the EMDR process. But the core of why the abuse that she came to work on hurt so bad was because it exploited a pre-existing vulnerability or fear or put a stamp of proof on you're out of control or your, you know, the core cognitions that we talk about, like, you are unsafe, you're out of control, you can't keep bad things from happening, no one sees you, no one loves you. It's like, these are the memories or component pieces that prove that to you.
In this way of working, I'm hearing the like EMDR basic training prompt of like you work with a specific representative memory, like a specific memory is what you're going in with. That's your target. You can't use large categories of memory or large themes be your target. It has to be a specific memory. But in how we're talking about the processing unfolding, we're looking for the theme. Uh-huh. And so my mind's like reconciling these two differences. And I think I'd be curious, Bridget, to hear from you on it too. Like, for me in that, it's the specific memory is what gets us into the activation.
Yes.
It wakes up the nervous system and everything that's stored. It's a doorway in, and we need that specific, because if you started that conversation with that client of like, let's start talking about like what it's like to never feel safe to like stand up for yourself.
Yeah.
Like, sure, I can talk about that theme.
Yeah, cognitively. Right.
And the ideas around that theme and how frustrating it has been in my life. But once we go into a memory and your body remembers that feeling.
Yeah.
We're now into this different schema of work that holds many memories.
Yes.
That built it, but we're in it on a, in a very holistic way. Our system's activated and ready to process and hopefully, you know, shift the way that it's stored.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the stuck points that I have with talking about EMDR as a trauma reprocessing therapy. Like, okay, yes, trauma is one of our best doors in, but what we're actually reprocessing is what the trauma exploited, not the traumatic memory itself. Like, that will be the resolution of the traumatic effects of that experience will be the result of treating the material underneath it that the trauma actually exploited. I mean, think of through as a listener right now, like all of the cases that you're working on and the memories that are typically showing up on our target lists. If you've listened to this podcast for any amount of time, you know that we see those targets on the list as representations of much deeper realities to them. Even something like a car wreck, we use that example all the time. Like, the reason the car wreck is still disturbing you is because it shook your grip on reality. It challenged in a way that you have no resources to buffer against, that the second you get in a car, what, why would you think that you would be able to avoid the bad thing from happening again? It fills your mind with a very specific example of a much deeper fear and makes you deathly afraid of that thing. I can't even get in a car. It's like, okay, that's not because of the accident. That's not because of the accident. The accident exploited a pre-existing fear of I'm hurtling through life hazardously, and at any moment, something really bad could happen. And maybe I just shouldn't get in the car anymore.
That like tracing that back is how we always end up in childhood.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it exploited in a pre-existing something that was developed by, whether you want to call it trauma or not, but by developmental experiences, by those critical experiences throughout childhood.
The way the chapter kind of flows is it's taking some of these elements or nodes of the associative channels and kind of breaking down what might happen in the desensitization phase with each of these things. So as they focused on imagery, we have content on new memories coming up. What happens if the image changes or the incident continues to unfold? The appearance changes of what your the appearance of the incident starts to change. You're looking at that. Just going with the outline of the text, Jen, what do you think about the imagery changing?
So for me, I think of any of the imagery, the way it's expressed, the way we're seeing the picture of it unfold or thinking of the incident, we're working with a symbol, which is kind of just building off of what you were just saying, is it's somehow it's symbolism, metaphor, that's attempt to express, communicate, and work with something deeper than that. So the indications of like imagery, the image changing, the perspective changing, like what angle am I seeing it from or through whose eyes am I able to look at it? All of that is symbolism that's going to allow their system to access new material, communicate about, express, hopefully integrate new material, other associative channels. And so I lean heavily into imagery and metaphor and symbolism throughout processing, to me, that's when we're going to get some of that like right hemisphere access rather than just like the storytelling, the words of what happened next and here's the timeline, but inviting them to work with and revisit images that are either documentation of what happened or very abstract imagery.
Yeah. The idea of image as symbol to me is really grounding. Again, another way to anticipate the flurry, or if you do have one memory that seems to become alive, mm-hmm. how to start making sense of what the aliveness of each piece represents. EMDR starting in a context where prolonged exposure was sort of the way trauma was dealt with, there's some narrative traces still embedded in the EMDR mm-hmm. process today of like what happened in mm-hmm. the incident, and almost assuming like that linear progression of take mm-hmm. me through the memory piece by piece. But I think if we shift away from that content oriented process that content oriented way of working through the memory to the process, now you're starting to see that for me, the memory in true context, like this isn't a chronological, like time capsule, this memory that we're working on. This is a symbolic representation of fears and, tragedy that this person has experienced, things that they don't, this perhaps is one of the most important parts, but things that they don't have resources to handle mm-hmm. within themselves. Whatever's coming up, it is in some way representing, here's something that I don't know how to handle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which to me, when we think of it in this lens, it means we can actually work with shifting and changing and interacting with the images and have it be effective in how our systems are then experiencing the moment. So there's a lot of, which we'll get into later chapters on like interweaves and how to handle blocked processing, but there's a lot of manipulation of the image that can take place for the purpose of processing, inviting them to like shift perspective or change the coloring of it or add a new person to the picture. Like, there's so much that you can do there that does not have to be accurate to the historical event, but it's significant in the what it is symbolizing to the system as it's going through and processing and integrating new information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And throughout, I do appreciate Francine's constant reminder to the reader that don't get lost in the thoughts. Mm-hmm. Don't get lost in the cognitive pieces of it. Go back to the body, the physical sensations, as that's the process that's working its way out. Mm-hmm. And so even as these changes emerge, if the client finds meaning in continuing processing, like things keep emerging, for me, I'm go with that, like send them back, or let's go there together. But if we start to see things confuse the client, or maybe there are mm-hmm. those stuck points or blocked processing, as it's called, going back to the body for the physical sensation or back to, and what does that feel like to you? Mm-hmm. Trying to get them to help us out by focusing on a specific point of it, and then we can continue the BLS again.
Mm-hmm. Our next section in talking about the associative channels is moving into sounds and thoughts. And the subcategories looking at like negative statements that come up, processing through those, mismatched experiences, mm-hmm. then kind of moving into more, we're starting then to dip into like, what are some of these more adaptive or positive thoughts that we might see interjected throughout the processing?
Yeah.
So I think in each of these categories, it's an attempt to give a prediction of what may come in and how do we make sense of it as it's happening to know where we at in this process. What comes up for you in kind of that next section with negative statements, mismatch? Yeah.
And just cognitions in general or discovery of meaning. In some ways, this is what I'm hoping the client will, again, kind of help me out as we go through to use their language to reflect on the experience of what's happening. For the client that I was referencing earlier to say, I guess I've never felt safe standing up for myself. That's an example to me of that language was not in the original assessment mm-hmm. when we were talking about the assault situation. It was that this person, it felt more to me at that time like it was about, I'm not able to defend myself. Like I'm not safe. I can't trust people. But it still felt kind of shallow in a way. Like those things would be natural takeaways from an experience like that. But why did it not resolve when the person was arrested and charged? Like, why didn't it go away? Mm-hmm. And that's the cue to me that it is because it disturbed something more fundamental to them. So changes in the cognition, that's what I'm kind of hoping starts to happen as we get off of the target, like the things that we thought were the target material, to discover the deeper pieces of it. Mm-hmm. And the sensation is going to naturally take us there. The meaning of the memory is going to take us there. And these cognitions are going to start to take us there as well. There is, to me, a conversation to be had on well-resourced versus under-resourced clients here. Mm-hmm. Because in the well-resourced clients, which is what I think of as who EMDR was made for in some ways, like people with adaptively stored material in their life that they can start to find as we're going through this. Those are the easier EMDR sessions. But the stuck point, really, I hear this a lot in consultation, is when the client has no adaptive material mm-hmm. to pair with this. Like these positive thoughts, like there's nothing in there. Insight, like no way. Like mm-hmm. any of the mismatch elements that we're hoping the client naturally finds, we don't find it.
Yeah. Or I've seen they find it on a very intellectual level.
Yeah.
They know I should believe this.
Yeah.
They don't know how to find an embodied feeling that matches that thought.
Yeah.
So I feel one way in my body, but I battle with that. And that kind of being that mismatch piece, I can battle with a cognitive awareness that it should be that shift.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the process you were alluding to earlier of A to B to C, like mm-hmm. that idea, for me, when we get into those places where it feels like we're grasping at vapor for any resource within the client or any adaptive material, that is a lot of learning that we're doing at the same time that as this client goes into this target and starts to uncover the depths of where it really came from, and they're starting to flail, like that's a space where we're learning so much about a part of them that has maybe never been able to find a resource or a strategy to get out of it. And that's where, for me, this is where Interweaves comes in more than just in like nothing's changing mm-hmm. in the image or something like that. Like, when we get into this part where the material starts unfolding and we're getting closer to the core of wherever it is, that's usually their expression of what their needed resources are. Mm-hmm. You and I have talked about creative resourcing before on the podcast. This is where that content comes from for me as the memory starts to unfold and we get deeper, closer to the core.
Mm-hmm. And that doesn't always fit in this nice, like, smooth process where it's like, okay, well, we'll just interject some creative resourcing right here and then we'll pick back up and keep moving. That can really look like the processing work that we're doing. Like, a successful target here is not a 0 and a 7. It's a revealing of what is under-resourced that we now have to pivot and shift into like a long span of time of developing templates where they have access to those thoughts and the feeling that goes with it.
Yeah.
And it can be a pendulating back and forth between processing and resourcing, but it's not like, oh, here's a little resource, do something creative right there and then move on. It's we need to like immerse this nervous system.
Mm-hmm. That's now like totally uncovered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Into an environment and have it exposed to the type of relational interaction that it never got to have,
yeah.
that it's needing in order to make new sense of that experience.
Yeah. The next section is on sensation and affect. So shifting in sensations or new emotions emerging, really working to complete the channels of processing. This for me is where I see a lot of clients that just tend to be more on the dismissive side of the spectrum. And I'll get the report of surprise, a lot of like all this stuff that's coming up as they're going through the phase four. Like, I don't know why I'm crying right now, or I don't know how to make sense of this emotion. Again, I use the parts language to help normalize that mm-hmm. that's okay. You know, it's good that it's coming up and it's a part of you that hasn't gotten the attention that it maybe needed when the original experience has happened. But the shift in sensation, again, all shift is good when it comes to what we're looking for in EMDR. But the sensation element of things start to feel different, whether that be in the positive direction or the negative, that's another cue for me that the body is alive. Mm-hmm. It's awake. It's moving. It's working on something. So depending on where the client is going, so much of this is it depends. We talk about that all the time. But depending on the trajectory that I feel the client going, I might let that keep going. So more just encouraging, like, does it feel safe to notice that? Go with it. If they do send me signals that I'm under-resourced here, I don't have what I need, we might pause, go back to anchoring kind of in safety and seeing if there is some resourcing that we want to do of what do we need in this moment to feel like we can keep going. Any type of impromptu resourcing like that. But shifting is the point.
Mm-hmm. Shift, any type of change or movement. I think so many people get a little bit afraid of it shifting into more activation, mm-hmm. more desperate thought patterns, more discomfort in their sensations.
Yeah.
To me, there's not an experience that we can create through this process that is about regressing the client. Mm-hmm. It's more about just revealing more authenticity.
Yeah.
And so if we're going into more discomfort in the body, it's not that like, oh, we're regressing into something that
it's getting worse,
different or new. Right. It's like, no, it's there. We're uncovering it.
Yeah.
And to really fully process and offer healing, we've got to uncover all of it at some point.
Yeah.
And invite all of that to be resurfaced in some way.
Hearing you phrase it like that makes me wonder what maybe consultees have said or shared with you. Because when I am explaining something like that, it's typically because a consultee has shared that I'm worried I did something wrong.
Oh, totally. All the time.
Yeah. Because they got worse. Mm-hmm. You know, the SUD went up.
SUD went up, or they started to get the... They started having more pain in their body, started feeling more activated, more angry, like any of those more numbers, not going from our 10 down to our zero, right? But as that starts to increase, there's this feeling of, what do we need to do to go
the other direction?
To better. Yeah. We need to move it the other direction. And it's like, oh no, we need to like ride it out, let it go to its furthest point that they can tolerate safely of that. And then we shift the direction of it.
Yeah. And I think that creates a lot of feelings, understandably, in clinicians. One of the things you use the word, but does it feel like you can make that as intense as it could be? That's a, like with anger is one, mm-hmm. one point in particular, or with like the panic response, I'll kind of ask like, what do you feel like it's trying to show you or trying to embrace that it's happening, validating that for the client, and then trying to let it do what it's supposed to do in the body instead of backpedaling and saying like, oh, that's not good. Let's get back to container. There are very few instances in which, and that's likely because the client is showing a lot of overwhelm that will pause and go back. But typically I'm wanting to be there with them mm-hmm. to go to the place that this needs to go. regardless of what the affect is.
And even if it's over multiple sessions, maybe the tolerance in that session is like, I've met my max for today. And so we can, you know, state change in that moment, offer resourcing and relief, but it's like for a thorough reprocessing. It's taking me back to the end of last episode. Melissa's statement around the goal is not just removing disturbance. It's about authentic expression. And I think that we do both. It's about authentic expression and then reducing the disturbance because it's been able to be expressed, regulated, seen, witnessed, like yeah. all of those things.
One of the things that's standing out to me about this conversation is how intimately involved the therapist is with helping the client, even in their process, make meaning and find direction with the unfolding of this.
Yeah.
Like it is so tied to the therapeutic relationship, because if something comes up in the client that the therapist has a pre-existing relationship with, like let's say when somebody expresses rage, I shrink.
Yeah.
That's going to change then how you facilitate that EMDR session, or when somebody starts getting really sad, like really sad. How do you handle that?
Yeah.
Like what feeling comes up in you? Your strategies are going to be challenged then.
Sure.
Even though we have all these years of training and all this stuff of like, this is what I'm supposed to do, your body is going to take over and start giving you ideas about how to handle that. And so taking a moment even to reflect on the importance of the therapeutic relationship and the presence that's in the room of how am I able to hold what the client is sharing as they're going through phase four, that is so intimately tied to the trajectory of where the session goes.
That's like so founded on our intersubjective
philosophy
way of working. Yeah. That it is about person to person. And that even if this is a very standardized process, it's best done when the two participants in it are both real humans and acknowledging their full humanness and being aware of how that influences the process and how do we work with it and how do we buffer against anything that might stand in the way with that.
Yeah, take us off of the track. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, maybe just as a way of landing for today, it's a question that I don't know exactly how to phrase, but maybe to put it provocatively, like, what do you like and not like about the way this conversation has gone, or the way like this section or this phase in particular is talked about?
Mm-hmm. I think the image that's coming up for me is the difference between, even in all of these like concepts that are here bolded throughout the chapter, of like what could come up of it being a process versus like a soup.
Yeah. Linear versus circular.
Yes. Yeah. That feels like so significant to me, because it's the hope of something as clear as this like linear process that, okay, we could have these thoughts are going to change. We're going to see changes in the image, and then changes in the thoughts are going to happen. And then we're at the body scan and changes in the body, you know, like that it's going to be this process. The hope of that, I think, discourages so many clinicians, leaves us not knowing what to do if it doesn't match the template that we anticipated. It leaves us in kind of a state of panic and defaulting to rules. And then it just takes away the like personal relationship nature versus like, it's a soup. It's got so many ingredients in it and so many different components and flavors. And we never know what we're going to get in each bite.
Mm.
Like there's going to be, I think of like a stew, like a vegetable stew or something. Mm-hmm. Like you don't know what's going to come in each bite of that. But if you can really just be present with each bite and not worried about, is there a rule for this or what it's supposed to be, we can have that real relationship as a part of it and still see it be tremendously effective.
Yeah. I'm adding on to your metaphor. But and how much easier it is to enjoy each bite when I know that theoretically I'm open to whatever's in it.
Yeah. Yeah, like, that it's not supposed to be just carrots in this spoonful.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Like, I'm open to whatever it is. That is a meditation mm-hmm. invitation right there. Like, what about the soup throws you off? Or are you open to it being whatever it is? And if you don't like green beans and anger is one of is a green bean to you,
yeah.
well, that's a part of the soup that's going to change how you feel about the whole thing.
Yeah.
And maybe in those moments, you try and pick out each green bean from every bite. And that is going to show up in your EMDR process where you're sensitive to the expression of affect maybe in one direction or if this goes to a certain depth, I'm not comfortable anymore. I think for me, it's similar as well as there's a depth of, I think, unintentional misrepresentation that happens in EMDR language to the neurobiological process that is unfolding. Even, and I've talked about this, feels like ad nauseum, but how memory is not chronological, like picture taking of a person's life. Like memory is the soup.
Mm-hmm.
Memory is association and symbolism as much as it is what actually happened. You can't take them apart.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at a person's target list or something like that, or history taking, if we have an expectation that these are our time capsules embedded in the client's story, we're going to miss the real purpose of what could come up as a memory emerges.
Mm-hmm.
That it's so much about how they made sense of themselves and their world around them, how safe they felt, how out of control they felt, how in control they felt, what options and resources they felt they had access to. Each of those questions came into the shaping of how that memory is stored.
Yeah. Yeah, and that in working with a snapshot of that experience, it gives us access to all of that, but that's not really what we're trying to change. It's just the door.
Just the door.
Just the door in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Vegetable stew sounds good.
It does. I know. Oh, anytime a good metaphor shows up, which soup is always a metaphor we end up landing on somehow.
Just a beautifully complex
food recipe
and inviting, like.
But then my brain just like adds to it and adds to it. I'm like, and each set is like another spoonful.
Another spoonful. That's right. Yeah.
What did you get in this bite?
And yeah. Then you can ask cool questions like, who made the soup?
Like,
you got to start talking about attachment influences. Like, you know, where's the beef? Yeah.
Okay. Good chat. So next episode, we will start looking at phase 5.
Yep.
And talking about installation.
And with the brevity that it's covered in this chapter, I imagine next episode we'll finish chapter 6, because each of those is like sometimes a paragraph or half a page.
We'll see. I never make promises on that. You never know
what
you
we're
going to spin up about.
That's true. And we'll see how back to basics this is by the end of it.
For sure. Thank you all for joining us today. We hope to see you, whether it's at the summit or in a group or somewhere, but hope to connect with you at some point in the future.
We hope that you have enjoyed this podcast episode and that it will help you help your clients in the process of EMDR therapy. If you are curious to learn more about something that you've heard today, check out our website at www.beyondhealingcenter.com and go to the trainings tab for more information on our upcoming EMDR and case conceptualization trainings. You can also contact us by emailing trainings@beyondhealingcenter.com. If you want to stay connected, please subscribe to this podcast for more episodes, leave us a review, and follow us on social media by searching Notice That Podcast.